Hi, and this is the Physics High Podcast. A quick quiz. Do you A, want to be inspired by science communicators? B, want to learn all about science education? C, want guidance on your scientific journey? Well, how about D, all of the above? Today, my guest is Professor Tara Murphy. Now, Tara is based at the School of Physics at the University of Sydney here in Australia. Now, Tara is an astrophysicist, and she's particularly interested in the short timescale events. So that involves black holes and neutron stars and other extreme physics events. Now, in 2017, LIGO discovered gravitational waves from the first neutron star merger. And as a result, a huge amount of radiation was given off, including radio waves. And Tara and her team was the first team to ever discover radio waves from a neutron star merger, from any gravitational wave generating event. Not only is she interested in astrophysics, her interests are also going into computational science. In fact, she strongly believes computational science skills are really important for students entering a science degree at university. And in 2013, she started a startup company called Grok Learning, which seeks to drive a passion and raise skills in computational learning, especially coding in high school students and also teachers. Now, she's a fantastic science communicator, wanting to break stereotypes of what science communication is all about. And so welcome, Tara.
Hi, great to chat.
So Tara, tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on.
So right now I'm working with the ASCAP telescope, which is the telescope you can see behind me. It's a new radio telescope in Western Australia, and it's really great at seeing really large bits of the sky to very high sensitivity very quickly. So it's perfect for what I work on, which is looking at astronomical objects that change really rapidly. Now, when you look at the sky with a radio telescope, most things don't change at all. They evolve very slowly over millions of years. So if you look at the radio sky tonight and then you look at it next year, it looks almost exactly the same. There's some tiny number of objects change on human timescales, and that's because there's some extreme event happening. So for example, a black hole forming, two neutron stars merging, a star flaring, and when that happens, it means there's a sign of interesting physics going on. And so what I'm doing is using ASCAP to search for these extreme events and use them to try and understand more about what's going on in them.
So what are the things are you learning about these extreme events? Give us a sample, I guess, of what you're picking up.
So one of the things we've been working on recently, because I think we're going to talk more about neutron star mergers later, but one of the things we've been working on recently is looking at stars in our local neighborhood. So a lot of people don't realize that a majority of stars in our galaxy are actually not like our sun. They're very cool dwarf stars called M dwarfs. And in fact, a lot of people predict that most planets in our galaxy will be orbiting M dwarf stars. So their behavior is really interesting. Now, some percentage of M dwarf stars have enormous flares. So these flares are thousands of times more powerful than the flares on our sun. And they also seem to have coronal mass ejections, which are the things that when they happen on our sun, they can wipe out telecommunications on Earth. So we're interested in looking at finding these flaring M dwarfs because it tells us about whether the planets around them might be habitable or not, because these flares would wipe out potential life on the planets. Now, the interesting thing about these stars that are flaring is they produce this emission that is circularly polarized. And for those of you that are not sure what polarization is, it's the same thing that your sunglasses use to block out some of the light from the sun. They filter polarized light. So these, we can find these stars in amongst, if we look up at with ASCAP, we can see 30,000 distant galaxies just in one image, but some tiny number of the sources of these flaring stars. And we can use this property of circular polarization to pick them out, the needles in a haystack, and study them. And this is something that we've been working on right now. We've just got our first results. We've found a whole load of new stars that have never been detected in radio before because there hasn't been a telescope that's been able to observe like this.
Now, going back to 2017, so here we're dealing with two neutron star mergers. Now, just for the sake of our audience, it wasn't the first detection of gravitational waves. That was 2015 with the merger of the two black holes. So this is two neutron stars occurring 130 million light years away, which is incredibly far away. And the event takes place in less than 2 seconds. And yet there's an incredible amount of energy related to it. What happened? Was it like, oh, I didn't know about that. Let's point out radio telescopes. Or was it something that you were prepared for?
Yeah, I think it was actually both of those things at the same time. So often in science, it seems that a new discovery is made very quickly and sometimes quite randomly. It literally happens overnight, and that was the case with this. But we had actually been preparing for several years. So our team had been working on what type of observations you need to conduct, how we would do them, how we would respond if there was an event. And LIGO had built up a network of astronomers around the world, over 1,000 people with 100 telescopes, all ready to receive an alert about a neutron star merger. So we don't expect, theoretically, to detect electromagnetic radiation from black hole mergers. So while we had done some follow-up of black hole mergers, we were all really waiting for a signal from LIGO that would say there was a neutron star involved. So that moment actually happened for me. I was at a conference in the US, and we were sitting in a room listening to people actually talk about radio transients. So it was very relevant to this. And when this alert came through from LIGO, so, you know, many of us in the room had signed up for these alerts to get them, people immediately started messaging each other, kind of, you know, not really listening to the speaker anymore. And when that speaker finished, about 15 people got up and walked out of the room so that they could discuss this in the corridor. So, like, it was super important. Everyone was trying to deploy their telescopes straight away. Obviously, their telescopes were located all over the world. And for us, the main telescope we were going to use, the Australia Telescope Compact Array, was located in Australia, where it was still the middle of the night. So we knew that this source was going to rise. The neutron star merger would become visible to our telescope sometime in the early morning. I can't exactly remember the time, but I think it was 9 or 10 a.m. And so to telescope time is very valuable. It doesn't just get given out randomly. You usually have to apply through an allocation process and write a proposal about why you need the telescope to do that science. And so in this case, when an event happens unexpectedly, you kind of need to ask for an override of the existing projects. And so we knew we were going to have to contact the director of the telescope and ask for this time. But obviously, at the time we were having the discussion, it was sort of 4 a.m. You know, one of my colleagues was pacing up and down saying, can you call them now? Can you call them now? Every 5 minutes, can you call them now? And I was saying, I'm not going to call the director at 4 a.m. The telescope, you know, we know the source doesn't rise until 10, so let's just wait a little bit. So 6 a.m. on the dot, I think, we rang the director, said, this incredible thing has happened. We need to get our telescope, you know, onto this straight away. And at the same time, we messaged my postdoc and PhD student and said, you know, get up, you need to get to CSIRO, get ready for observing. And so in a way, it was both of the things you said. It was instant, you know, very rapid reaction to an event that we didn't know was going to happen. But at the same time, we wouldn't have been able to respond like that if we hadn't been preparing for years, getting all the both the technical skills, the observing skills, and also all the collaboration and politics in place that would allow us to, you know, ring the director at 6 a.m. and say, let us start observing. So, yeah.
Now, my understanding is there's a delay. So the radio waves you received was like 15 days after the actual event.
Yes.
But that's because of the interaction of the radio waves with the surrounding space, really. And as a result, you're getting a lot of data from that surrounding space and of the actual event. What did you learn? What information did you glean from that over the 3 years that you've had the chance to analyze that data?
So just to talk about your first point, which is the reason the radio waves come later, because that is something that actually a lot of people find really confusing, because radio waves travel at the speed of light, so do gravitational waves, so do gamma rays. In fact, one of the huge discoveries of this event, GW170817, was the fact that the gamma rays arrived within 1.7 seconds of the gravitational waves. we were able to show, not our team, but the wider, you know, collaboration of LIGO was able to show that gravitational waves did in fact travel at the speed of light to a factor of 1 in 10 to the 15. And so that was the result that was, you know, reported in the media as Einstein was right, because that was one of the remaining predictions of general relativity, that that gravitational waves would travel at the speed of light. So then, because that happened very quickly, you know, the gamma rays were detected 2 seconds later. A lot of people get confused. Why was the radio emission detected 15 days later? Do radio waves travel slower? But that's not the case. They're also traveling at the speed of light. But the thing that's interesting about this explosion is it's a long evolving thing over days. So first there's the moment when the black hole forms, and that's the, you know, where the gamma rays are emitted. But then the radio waves actually come from the ejector material and the explosion expanding out into the space around the neutron stars and causing a shock as it interacts with the medium, the space around it. And so when you have that shock, you then get radio emission from the electrons that are accelerated in that shock front. And so what you see is a completely different part of the explosion. So what did we learn from this whole thing? Every different wavelength we observed, 70817, gives us different information about what happened. So the gamma rays, they tell us about the gravitational waves traveling at the speed of light. But then astronomers also observed this in optical and infrared light. And that showed us that the merger caused what's called a kilonova. And by measuring the abundance of different elements in that kilonova explosion, people were able to work out that neutron star mergers also produce these heavy elements that we see on Earth, such as gold and platinum. So neutron star mergers are one of the places they occur. The radio emission, which comes again from a completely different part of the process to the optical infrared gamma radiation, gives us a different part of the story. And what the radio emission tells us is the energy of the event, and it can tell us about the angle of the jet of radiation that's coming out. And another really interesting thing that came from the radio observations is a new way of measuring the Hubble constant, H naught, which is the expansion of the universe. It's a bit technical to go into in this interview, but it basically allows us to break a degeneracy that then allows us to use the neutron star merger as a standard siren and hence as a way of measuring the expansion of the universe. And the reason that radio let us do that is we could get these really, really precise measurements with VLBI, it's called, very long baseline interferometry, that tell us about the angle of the jet emission that's coming out and its expansion. So, putting it all together, it was just one of the biggest, you know, scientific events in recent history, how much knowledge was generated by this one thing.
Just to clarify for those who are listening, you didn't all this discover yourself, of course. This is thousands of scientists now writing papers on this. So this one 2 second event produced not only all these heavy elements, but all of these thousands of papers that came as a result of that. What an amazing for one
That's
event.
Right. I mean, look, it's probably the biggest thing that me and my team will be involved in our scientific careers. And yes, I do want to emphasize that we played a tiny, tiny, you know, part in it. There were thousands of people around the world, and we contributed one unique, you know, important, small part of this whole discovery. But I think everyone on my team, we knew that this was something big, and that, you know, normally the science that you do every day, it's really interesting to scientists, but it is quite incremental. You publish a lot of papers that maybe not that many people will read. And in this case, we all felt we sort of touched something really big, you know, like we were part of a huge discovery, and it was super exciting for everyone on the team. Also quite stressful because they were working round the clock under a lot of pressure, a lot of competition, and a lot of pressure to get things right, you know. And I mean, as you would know, as scientists, that's one of the things we really, really obsess over, is we don't want to say things that, you know, might be wrong, publish things that might be wrong, get any data analysis wrong. And so we had a team of young scientists here in Sydney, postdoctoral scientists and PhD students, who were trying to work faster than they'd ever worked on anything, but also with me saying, you have to be really, really, really sure you're right, which, you know, as you know, it's hard to work both fast and super carefully at the same time.
So just that one last little question before we move on. You were credited, your team credited for the first discovery of the radio waves, and yet you said the scientists were rushing forward to all their telescopes to train their eye on this event. Was it a bit of a fluke that you became the first team, or was there something that led to that?
Yeah, that's actually really interesting. So of all those telescopes, I think there were about 100 telescopes deployed to try and find electromagnetic radiation. There's some space telescopes, which obviously are run by NASA and ESO and so on, not by any individual groups. And then there was an enormous number of optical telescopes, because the real key was to find something that looked like we expected a kilonova to look like. With radio, we had two possible ways of searching. We could either look for a radio emission that wasn't associated with any other wavelength event, and that's what we started doing. We just started doing an untargeted search. But as soon as they identified this optical counterpart, we all started observing that optical counterpart. Now, there are many radio telescopes in the world, and actually the radio community is extremely friendly. The worldwide radio community, in generally, great collaborators. You know, we work with people in India and China and the Netherlands and the US and South Africa and Australia and Canada, and we all work together a lot. There's a lot of collaboration. But in this case, the two telescopes that were most sensitive, once you know where something is, once you know where the object is, the two telescopes that were the most sensitive were the VLA in New Mexico in America and the Compact Array in Narrabri in New South Wales. And so we were working with our American colleagues, and they actually got a marginal detection, with the VLA. The VLA is more sensitive than the Compact Array. And because we were collaborating, they sent it to us and said, you know, we think we might have something. What do you think? And so we were observing as well with the Compact Array and reprocessing our data. And, you know, when we combined the VLA data and the Compact Array data together, we could get an even better, sensitivity observation. And we could also confirm if both telescopes in two different places and two different data processing, you know, pipelines are seeing the same thing, then you become a lot more confident that, you know, what you detected was real. So it was actually the very first detection was actually our American friends. And then we observed the same thing the next day. And we also got this marginal detection. And then we ended up combining forces and publishing a paper together. So it was very much both collaboration and, you know, competition. But I think it was exciting because, you know, it showed our Australian telescopes, they're, you know, as good as the best in the world. And so working together with our American friends, we were able to, like, validate each other's observations. And that's always an important part of science. Now, most of the time in science, like I said, you're kind of doing things that other people have done before to some extent. But in this case, we didn't know. So you said the first detection was, you know, 15 days later. The thing is, that's the point. We didn't know whether the theoretical models, they predicted anything from no radio emission at all through to radio emission months later through to, you know, anything in between. So what do you even, how often do you look? You know, do you, and so we were looking every few days. It's another reason why we were collaborating with our American colleagues, because it meant that we could use both telescopes, you know, looking more often by alternating between the telescopes. And so after 2 weeks, we've been looking, everyone else was, you know, had all these results and we still hadn't detected anything in radio. And then after 2 weeks, you know, we actually did. So it was, you're working sort of in the you don't know what to expect. Then that kind of reproducibility and, you know, validation was even more important.
Now, changing tack away from your work and more about you and how you started in science. Now, am I understanding a gift from your grandparents had a key role to play in getting you to science? You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny. It was an indirect gift. So I had, both my parents were very supportive of, education and science and so on. But I came from a family where no one, had been to university. There wasn't any people with a scientific background. But I had been given, I think it was when I was, 7 or 8, and I'd been given £5. I grew up in my early childhood was in England. And I'd been given £5 from my grandparents, and my mum had taken me like to the bookshop and, said, you can pick whatever you want. And I had spotted this astronomy encyclopedia on the top shelf. And I just was straight away, like it was this bright red book. It was very appealing. It had pictures of the planets on and I think a rocket on the front. And I was straight away like, I want that, that's it. And she was sort of like, are you sure that's what you want? That's the only thing you'll be able to get with this birthday money or whatever. I'm like, definitely, that is what I want. So I got that and I just used to read it sort of, back to back constantly. It was one of those ones that just covers everything from, space exploration to distant galaxies. And, probably now, 30 years later, most of it's wrong, actually. The way there's so many things that have changed in our understanding of our solar system and, galaxies, and the Big Bang and so on since then. But yeah, it really fascinated me as a child. And I think that I've definitely had that interest all along. But I also want to counter that story because I do love the story. It definitely got me involved. But I was also interested in lots of other things. So it's just one of the things I like to clarify because I don't want people to think that to become an astronomer, you need to have been just obsessed with this one passion for your whole life. I was certainly interested in that, but I also really loved animals and, literature and history and all kinds of other stuff too. But astronomy has definitely like always been there as a thread.
Jane Austen was a thread there too, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So exactly. So when I read, for example, and I know like lots of people, there's that sort of view of a classic science nerd, and there are certainly lots of people in science who are nerdy. I can guarantee I work with, corridor full of them. But there are also lots of us that are not that nerdy. And so, when I read books in my spare time, I don't actually read science fiction. I don't read popular science. I read literature and I read Jane Austen and I read stuff like that. And I just think it's really important because there are lots of people that I like science fiction too. I just, it's not the only thing I like. And I think that sometimes in science that gets lost a bit, that you don't have to be mega nerdy to be a good scientist. You do have to be able to put up with nerds, though. I would say that. Yeah, you have to be able to work amongst them. Yeah.
You and I share a little common thing. My first real experience of working on a computer way back in 1984 was a BBC computer. And I understand that was your first computer as well.
Yeah, that's right. And the computer was a transformational experience for me. So again, like being in a family that was very pro education but didn't have any particular, training themselves, they were always very keen to support me. I was obviously a little bit smart as a kid, and at school, I'd often finish my work early at school, and the teachers let me play on the computer. There was this cool, pretty sure it was a MUD, like a game where you explore by text, and you could go to the beach, and there was always a lot of seagulls screeching. I remember that about the game. I'd love to discover what it was. But when the school was upgrading their one computer, they offered to my parents, to give them that school computer. And so I had this computer at home, and yeah, it totally blew my mind. I mean, I think as a young kid, when you're exploring stuff yourself, and I remember my mum bought this book. This is probably one of my favorite stories, but I hope it's not offensive to my mum. Sorry, mum. I do tell it in my lectures. She bought this book of programs, from the shop, from the newsagent, so you could type into the computer. So she bought this. Yeah, she bought this book of programs in BASIC. And like I was just this, 7 or 8 year old kid and sitting with my mum who knew nothing about computers. She would say, well, I think you just open this and you obviously type this stuff in. And she could type, but she would be typing in. She'd go, I don't know what this is. Like, this doesn't mean anything. I don't know why we're typing it in. But it was really cool. Obviously, I started learning programs and programming. And then, one day we got to a total revelation experience for me, which was she was looking through the book to see what we should do, and there was one that said it did English to French translation. And she thought that would be good because she liked, you know, other languages and stuff. And so we started typing in the English-French translator program. And then we got to the bit where you were actually typing in the English words and the French words. And she said, oh, well, this doesn't, I don't see the point of this. We're just telling it, you know, what the answers are. And I think at that moment, like, it all clicked in my mind and I understood what we were doing. You know, like, I understood what coding was, what computer programming was. I don't know if it ever clicked for Mum, but we did do a lot of programming, you know, together. So, yeah, it was really cool for me because it sort of just, again, set me on that path of thinking this stuff is really interesting, you know, and then being able to get computers to explore those things, as it turned out, is very important in my job because, in fact, the majority of what observational astronomers do these days is computer-based. I mean, I have a MOOC called Data-Driven Astronomy, and that's what we do. We start with these data sets and we explore them. We test hypotheses with them, or we do open-ended exploration to see what we can find. And of course, all of that is done with computers.
Now, Tara, your passion is astrophysics. Your passion is computational science, but your third passion is science communication. What does science communication mean for you?
Yeah, I think it means a few different things. Firstly, I like many people, I love science and I love sharing science with other people. And so I just love that moment when, you know, when, for example, when we discovered the 170817 results and, you know, I was discussing them. My babysitter said, oh, you know, I saw you on the TV. Can you explain what that's about? And, you know, we had this long discussion about that. And she said, wow, I had no idea, you know, any of that. I had no idea we could even see other galaxies. And, you know, it was a great, I love that moment where you can explain something to someone and they see the world in a different way. So at a personal level, I just love sharing science with people. And it's also why I like teaching at university. But then I also think from in a bigger picture point of view, I mean, scientists have an obligation. We're funded by the government mostly. We're funded by the taxpayer. And one of the, I think, obligations that comes with that is sharing our results and letting people know, you know, what they're getting for that investment in science. And so I think it's both. It's both, you know, personally good. It's great to excite people. It's great to inspire students to pursue those, you know, science and math subjects. And it's also, I just consider it part of my job to kind of, you know, help share the results that we've got. And I think when I'm out at the telescopes, you know, people come and visit parks, for example, and it's a great cultural icon. I mean, people are proud that an Australian, you know, telescope has achieved so much. And I think we're proud of it and everyone else is as well. So I think it's a whole load of things. And then obviously people also, like you have, ask me to talk about, you know, careers and my own path and so on. And so then my passion there is just kind of showing people that there's a lot of different paths to being a scientist. And, you know, you don't have to just be one kind of person to be a scientist.
Do you believe you, or, and I'm saying you as a scientist or scientists in general, have a responsibility to communicate scientific process in our society?
Yeah, I think that's actually, you know, that's something I'm most passionate about in the communicating science. I think we actually do a pretty good job of explaining sort of, you know, what is dark matter or, you know, what are exoplanets like? We like to focus on communicating the facts of science, I would say, but we don't always communicate how science works. And in some ways, I think that for the challenges we face in society, like the scientific literacy when it comes to people understanding vaccines or climate change, neither of which, of course, I'm going to talk about because they're well out of my expertise. But I think part of that, when we talk about that scientific literacy, part of the problem is people not understanding how science actually works. And so I think I always like, if you've read any of my articles, I always like to try and write about how the thing happened, how we discovered things, how students discovered things, and how our method, you know, and approach works. Because to me, that's as important and actually just as interesting as the scientific, you know, thing we discovered. I also love celebrating the success of my students, and often it's them that are making the discoveries, so that's great. But yeah, I think a lot of the debates in terms of the public scientific literacy, a lot of those come from a misunderstanding of how science works and how scientific information is validated. And so to me, that's like a really important part of it.
Focusing our attention now to our viewer or our listener, whether they're listening on podcast or they're watching other on the video, particularly if it's a high school student, what advice would you give them if they are thinking about exploring a career in science or at least doing a further studies in science?
Yeah, I think there's two sides to the advice that I would give. I mean, firstly, there's the side where, look, I love science. I think it's a really great career. It's very hard to get into, but it's really fun. So I think that in terms of if you're passionate about it, if you're enthused by it, if you like understanding the world around you, if you want a job where you get paid to try and understand the world around you, science is awesome. And so on that side of things, I would encourage everyone, even if you don't think you're a science nerd, even if you're not the smartest person in your class, you don't have to love sci-fi and you don't have to get 100 in maths, you know, to become a scientist. I certainly am neither of those things, and I'm here and I'm being a scientist. So that, I would say, I would encourage everyone who's thinking about it to go a bit further. So then the other side of it is, how do you go a bit further? Like, what do you actually need to get from you in high school to being me, an astrophysicist? And I think that, unfortunately, the answers may be a little bit boring, but the first thing you pretty much need to do is go pretty well in maths and your science subjects at school. So I would say that's the number one thing you could do, is make sure you have a pretty good maths background. It's the foundation of almost everything we do, and increasingly computing as well. You know, that's how we do things. So maths and computing together essentially allow you to be a scientist, to do science. So doing biology and chemistry and physics, they are what allow you to understand the science. And then the maths and the computing are how we do science. So I think that there's the, like, follow your dream, follow your passion. If you want to, you can do it. And then to do that, the first step for you in high school is, you know, choose those science subjects and try and aim to get into a science degree at a university. Just a BSc is all you need to, you know, get into to start that journey.
Just a little extension on our advice point here. Stereotypically, particularly in the physical sciences, there seems to be a definitely heavier weighted to the male than to the female in terms of uptake, in terms of science and so forth. As a female scientist, what advice would you have to girls, to women who are thinking about science degrees but are concerned about the gender disparity?
So look, there is a gender disparity. I mean, in physics, I think about 25% of, you know, physicists are women. So it's clearly a male-dominated area. I don't think there's any reason why any women that are interested in science or physics or maths, you know, can't pursue that. I think that what I would encourage women to do is not be repelled or rebuffed by the thought that everyone around you actually knows more. So if I can, you know I'm talking to the whole audience here, and most of the men I work with are very lovely and it's all great, but I would say that one of the things that's a bit different is sometimes your peers at high school and at university, they may seem more confident about their knowledge than, you know, than they really should be. And so I would just say to women, don't be put off by the fact that there may be people that, you know, act like they know everything about physics, but in fact, you know just as much about physics as they do. So, you know, if you can get through high school, get to uni and make connections with, you know, women scientists, I know that me and many of my colleagues, we're happy to talk to anyone that wants to, you know, talk to us, and just keep that confidence going that you can do this. Because in fact, when we look at the marks, you know, women do just as well. There's just sometimes a perception that, you know, some of the male students know more. The main thing I would say, keep going.
into our last question, and a much more lighthearted question, I'm going to give you an opportunity to share a little bit about what you're passionate about right at the moment. I guess in a turn of phrase that I've borrowed from Tom Gordon, whom you know, what are you nerding about at the moment? If you're in a mixed company, what would you love to talk about? What would you teach us? What would you share with us?
Well, the funny thing is, I do have something that I'm really getting into at the moment, because next semester I'm introducing this new unit of study at Sydney Uni called The Apocalypse in Science and Culture. And so it's about looking at crises and current, you know, scientific issues like climate change and so on through the lens of apocalyptic scenarios. So after telling you that I'm not really a nerd, that the course is actually about movies and books, you know, about apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic worlds. And so what we're going to do is learn about the social side, so, you know, preppers and bunkers, but also about the things that might cause apocalyptic events. So obviously extreme climate events, nuclear, you know, meltdowns. And then we're also going to look at what would happen if you were trying to rebuild in a post-apocalyptic world. Those kind of questions are often scientists, when we're just chatting at lunch, we do ask each other, like, do you reckon if all the textbooks and the internet were taken away, you would actually be able to build an engine yourself, you know? Or do you think you could actually grow food? You know, could the biologist grow food without instructions? So I think that we like talking about that kind of stuff at lunch. And so we thought, why not do a course where, you know, we're getting the students to think about those issues. And so what I'm really passionate about at the moment is learning about these post-apocalyptic scenarios and, you know, working out whether I really could survive. I need to work out who's going to be on my apocalypse survival team. Like, I'm basically picking people, you know, we need to get their critical skills.
Who's on your team? You don't have to name names, but who are you picking?
Well, there is this guy in Western Australia who works on the telescopes, and I always say he's on my team. He's like an engineer. He's really good. I'm not going to name him, but if he sees this, he'll know who I mean, because I've told him for years he's on my team. He can operate radios. He can build radio telescopes. You know, he can do all of that stuff from scratch, and I feel like that's the kind of stuff that we're definitely going to need. You know, one dimension of my team needs that. But, you know, there's other questions as well. There's social and cultural questions. If the internet was gone, would any of that stuff, our current cultural context is dependent on things like YouTube. If the internet disappeared, would we have access to any of our cultural heritage? So, you know, there's really some cool questions that I think, you know, we can ask about this. So that's what I'm nerding out about at the moment.
So when you're thinking of apocalyptic, that sounds all very depressive, but is there a flip side? It's like, oh, I'm going to have all this quiet around me that's going to...
That kind of depends on what movie you watch, doesn't it? Like, it's not normally that quiet in the post-apocalyptic world. It seems to be mainly people walking around, like, you know, with guns. I think so far what we've seen in terms of people being interested in this course is some people are really interested in the serious side and some people are really interested in the fun sci-fi side, and we're hoping to bring all of those sides together and, you know, explore all of them. I think you can take it in a very flippant way, and then, of course, COVID has happened and suddenly it's not funny at all. It's very serious.
So if there's one apocalyptic story, movie, TV series... what's your favourite?
Mine has to be The Road. Yeah, Cormac McCarthy. I wouldn't say it's uplifting, though. Well, it's meant to be uplifting at the end, I guess. Yeah, it's largely not on the way. I just love the sort of depressing minimalism of it. It's really powerful, yeah.
Well, Tara, it's been a wonderful chat with you. I've learned actually a lot, particularly more about the events that had occurred 130 million years ago, and a little bit about what drives you, computers and apocalypse, which is...
thanks for the chat, it's been really fun.
Yeah, it has been really fun. Thanks very much for joining us, and I hope we have an opportunity to chat on other things later.
Okay, thanks. Bye, everyone.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please remember to subscribe to get notifications of upcoming interviews. And you can find me on YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter at Physics High. My name is Paul from Physics High. Till next time.